Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. Should staffers in the Michigan Senate and House have union representation? Former State Senator Wayne Schmidt, a Traverse City Republican, believes the need for a union is really not there, and that being a legislative staffer is not a clock-in and clock-out type of job. Meanwhile, past State Representative Lamar Lemons III, a Detroit Democrat, would be against staffers being represented by a union that's involved in the political process. Also, Lindsay Huddleston II of Sports Psychology Solutions is promoting a bill allowing high school athletes to make money off their name, image, and likeness, NIL. He adds that currently in Michigan, young athletes could have their previous wins protested and deemed null and void if they accept social media brand deals. Additionally, MERS speaks with Director Amy McMillan of the Huron-Clinton Metro Park System. The park system is now looking to raise $2.4 million over 3 years to support more learning programs on science and outdoor recreation, as well as more free swim lessons. Now, here's MERS podcast host Samantha Schreiber and editor Kyle Malin.
Thank you so much, Jeff Smith, for kicking off today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. Today, for our opening roundtable discussion, we are zooming in on a story MERS News recently broke on Thursday, March 7th, on a group of staffers within the Michigan Capitol leading an effort to be unionized. Some staffers within the Michigan State House of Representatives, specifically employees serving under House Speaker Joe Tate's purview, are taking cards from co-workers regarding their interest in holding an election to be represented by a Teamsters local. There has been a reported desire among staffers in the Capitol to unionize in the past, but any previous aspirations did not come to fruition. Unionized legislative employee unions are viewed as a recent development by groups like the American Bar Association. For example, in summer 2021, a local union was certified to represent the state legislative employee union in Oregon. And starting in May of this year, legislative employees in the Washington legislature will have the right to participate in union bargaining. Today, we are joined by former State Senator Wayne Schmidt, a Grand Traverse County Republican. Hello, how are you doing?
Good morning. Great to be on the podcast. I think this is the first time ever, too, by the way.
Oh, my goodness. That's crazy. And we have former State Representative Lamar Lemons, who served as past Detroit State Senator Betty Jean Alexander's chief of staff from 2019 through 2022. Hey, Lamar, how are you?
I am well.
So just to kind of kick off this conversation, and I'll start with you, former Senator Schmidt. When you initially saw this headline, what were some of your earliest reactions? What are the thoughts running through your head right now?
I was just thinking about logistics and such, and I thought of my friend Bill Black at the Teamsters. I'm a former Teamster in Chicago, HERE Local 1 employee in Chicago, so I have two union cards. And I thought it was a little interesting that they'd want to unionize direct staff to an elected official. I understand bureaucracies and those type of areas, but I don't quite get something quite this personal in terms of someone's legislative director or chief of staff or any of the other assistants. So I was a little surprised at it, but then Mr. Malin called me and I said, okay, let's talk about it. I know Representative Lemons from his past service, and then also when he was chief of staff to the senator there in her freshman term. So yeah, looking forward to talking about it.
Lamar, what are your initial thoughts right now?
I was wondering how logistically it would work for individual legislators and their staff. And I was thinking perhaps it would have to be something like the Screen Actors Guild, because the composition of the legislature, even with extended term limits, as well as the leadership and the amount of staff changes as the leadership changes. So if your party is in power, you have more staff. If your party is not in power, you have less staff. And so also with the budget, if your party is in the majority, you have a slightly larger budget. And if your party is in the minority, and depending on how much they're in the minority and what the legislature decides at any particular time, is what your resources are. That's one. And the other thing is, because it's a fluid position and there are elections every 2 years for the House, every four in the Senate, you would have to be organized in such a fashion that it would be like the SAG, and you could pick from these people or bring in other new people who would become SAG, which is Screen Actors Guild, but I keep saying SAG, the Screen Actors Guild, which a union that famous Ronald Reagan famously was a member of. If you have that type of a union or guild, then it perhaps could work. I'd have to look at the models that were done in those other progressive states.
Senator Schmidt, you would see the allure if you were a young staffer to doing some kind of unionizing activity, because let's say you work for a representative that you're only making, I don't know, let's say $30,000, but somebody in the other office right next door to you is making $40,000, $45,000 doing the same exact kind of work. And would unionization make sense in the sense that we could have the House in general just in charge of pay, as opposed to having it be under somebody's personal office allotment? There would be more standardization and maybe a ladder schedule so people could advance up the ladder and improve your standing based on experience.
Well, I think that possibly could work. And Lamar brings up some very good points. I appreciate his perspective, having served in the House too. The real issue, though, is you're given an allotment. And in the House, I remember the dark days of 09 and 10, the budget crisis is going on. The allotments got smaller. But I know that former Speaker Dillon and Minority Leader Kevin Elsenheimer negotiated it. The only difference really was about $5,000. The majority party got $5,000 more, basically the equivalent of a mailer, but two packages, everything else was the same. And I know that that continued forward. If you look at also what, for example, having just left the Senate, I know that when Majority Leader Shirky came in and working with Democrat Leader Jim Ananick, it went from a 2-4, two staffers in the minority, four in the majority, to a 3-4. And then under Majority Leader Brinks, that moved up to any number of packages, healthcare packages, if you will, that changed. Plus, the pay has gotten better. The allotments have gotten better. And, you know, the House and Senate business offices have made things much better. But it's still tough. I guess you could do that. You could have a card, you know, like the SAG model that the former rep was talking about. But in reality, these are your personal key people in your office. How could you have a chief of staff or a legislative director in the House go, well, I negotiated this. This is what I get paid. I'm not going to work past 5 o'clock. The work rules, the situations would be, I don't think you could do it. Plus, some offices like to run a lot leaner with staff than others. And so that's again, up to the representative. As I said, bureaucratic staff, other areas, that's fine if they choose to unionize. They also have civil service. But I think in the legislature, it's just too difficult. And the allotments have gone up, and so has the pay. And there are a lot of other opportunities. Healthcare is top notch. There's some good things. Good 401k, too. And in the era of term limits, as Lamar mentioned, the turnover is huge.
Why is the turnover so big, Representative Lemons? Is it because there's more opportunities, the pay isn't that great, that these are stepping stone jobs, or is it because of the legislator themselves that they're churning through people to see who the correct fit is?
All of the above. First of all, the turnover was great because of term limit, and the legislator himself was at least at the four-year mark, was looking where he was going to land. Depending on their age, it was a disruption in their career path, and they have to try to make the necessary corrections so that they don't fall behind and in the private sector, where they would be going very quickly. Also, it takes sometimes a while to have the best fit. A lot of times you bring in the people who worked on your campaign, but you find out they may have been good campaign workers, but they don't make necessarily the best staffers, or they really can't stand a commute.
If I may chime in, Lamar is dead on. And that's the problem. That's what makes it such a fluid situation. This isn't something where you're going to see a career of 30 years. Now, I know some people that have worked in the legislature a long time, but they've been from a certain area. They've gotten along with certain elected officials, and it's just kind of worked out that way. But a lot of these staffers, this has always been a stepping stone. It was never seen to be as 30 years, especially in the era of term limit. And as I said, the allotments have gotten bigger, the pay has gotten better, the healthcare is good, the 401k is portable. You, under the old system, you might not even qualify for a pension. So, you know, there's some, I'm sure, some young idealists out there in Democratic offices, but...
A question I would have for you, Senator, is, you know, as someone who was term limited at the end of 2022, and also your party was transitioning to now being the minority caucus of the Senate chamber. I mean, the staff that you said goodbye to, how many of them stuck around the legislature and how many of them moved on to other areas?
Well, you raise an interesting point. And one of the things that I was proud of is that all my staff got jobs. And I was very fortunate both in the House and the Senate that we made sure, and I say we, whether it was my legislative director, an old hand like Joe Underwood or Connie Russell, helped develop staff. And they'd go on to other offices, or maybe they went into the lobby corps or into business. All of them have continued to be successful. Knowing in a term limited environment, my goal was one, serve the constituents in the state as best I could. And two, knowing that I had a finite time, make sure that my staff landed on their feet. You know, I'm so proud of all of them. Martin Johnston stayed with Senator Victory. My last two chiefs have gone on to successful jobs in the lobby corps, knowing, you know, budgets and the passions that they cared about. And the pay got better. We ran a tight ship in terms of how we spent our money and was able to offer a decent wage. Again, if you want to make a lot more money, going in the legislature, whether it's unionized or not, is not the place to go. Plus, you've got all the campaign work.
Well, that brings me to my next point here, too, Wayne. I mean, you could make the argument, though, that with term limits, you actually need a more professional staff. And if you do some type of unionization structure, you could create an environment where you would have more professional staff who have experience, who could enter a pool or whatever. And
I disagree.
Once your person's termed out, then you enter this pool and the next person could bring you on.
But you already have that. Good incoming legislators talk to the outgoing legislators and different people, and they do offer. But if someone's hell-bent on bringing in their campaign manager as, say, a front desker or a back desker, then that's what they get to do. And you certainly, you know, I think one of the other problems is that, let's say you're, I'm going to say on a Democratic side of things, you know, all of a sudden you get crossways with the Teamsters and they decide that they don't like your boss anymore and they're going to campaign against him or her. Well, now you're paying dues to an organization that's going to campaign against your boss. That doesn't always go well. And these jobs, especially some of the Northern Michigan and UP legislators, hey, I need you up here this month. I was very fortunate to have staff that were willing to go, but I do most of it myself. But if I needed them up there, that's not a 9-to-5 job anymore. So your work rules, I'm interested to see, and Representative Lemons brought it up, what happens in Oregon and Washington State? I want to give credit to the past leaders in the House and the Senate for increasing pay, for increasing allotments, for offering better parity of staffing levels, because it doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat, you need good staff. But that's also part of the job of the caucuses is to develop that, not the union. Their job would be to bargain for better wages, and that's that. Just because you get paid more doesn't mean you're better.
Senator Schmidt, you also made it sound that it's kind of a individual responsibility of that legislator to support your staff, to make sure that they don't just go into a abyss of the unknown when you're termed out. Here's my question. I mean, if it's up to that legislator individually to be an advocate for their staff members, who's there to protect the staff of a legislator who says, okay, I'm out of here, peace out, and does nothing for that staff in return?
Well, that happened. I saw that in 2010. The House was, I think it was a 67-43 split, 67 Democrats. You remember, it was never supposed to be like that, but yet somehow they got a 67 majority after we gerrymandered, supposedly. That's another topic. When Governor Granholm left, there were staff scrambling everywhere. And I'll give credit to Suzanne Miller Allen. She was a longtime political hand, only person to serve as chief of staff to the Speaker of the House and a majority leader. She helped good staff. It didn't matter whether they were Republican or Democrat. Good staff is good staff. And even to this day, I have had Dems reach out and say, hey, Suzanne heard that I was switching or looking to move. and she was trying to help me get a job. We need to protect the institution too. And that's what good leaders do, what good senior staff does. And that doesn't come, quite frankly, from unionization. That has nothing to do with it. Good staff usually finds jobs, and staff that didn't make the cut, and you know what I'm talking about, and the good representative knows too, the guys and gals that knock doors, help people get elected. Yeah, there is a thank you for that, because that's part of it. You just can't go and say, well, this is going to be 9 to 5 today. This is what I'm going to do. And that's it. It's not a clock in, clock out type of job.
Representative Lemons, I wanted to bring this subject up to you because Senator Schmidt had mentioned this about potential political repercussions and the conflict that could result if the Teamsters are not supporting your boss, let's say, for a reelection bid, or they're advocating for a certain bill, and would they have any kind of certain pull? Is that a concern you would have on any kind of unionization effort?
Absolutely. That's why I gave the SAG model, where they're like the screen actors would be the political operatives, a guild or something like that, so which is not associated, affiliated. Teamsters endorse and support candidates. I would have, I would have a problem, a UAW. As a matter of fact, I just came up with a race with a union. I had 100% union voting record, and yet all the unions mobilized and worked to support my opposition, unprecedented form. And remember, I had a 100% union scorecard voting. So they just decided that they wanted this other person, for whatever reason, I don't want to go into. So now how could that union, now how would I feel safe having that union representing my staffer when it was that union that just literally just put all their machine and put all their effort to see that I was unsuccessful. And then later on, maybe in a different race, I would be successful. The lines were changed, the county lines, et cetera. It was more in Detroit. Despite what happened, Detroit had a dismal turnout, but I won Detroit. And they did an unprecedented amount of campaigning, we'll just leave it at that, of campaigning for my far lesser experienced opponent.
Do you feel that Speaker Tate is being cornered to give this effort his blessing? You think about it, he wants to be remembered as one of the leaders who repealed right to work, a pro-union Democratic leader leading a pro-union caucus. Do Democrats have some extra pressure to give this the green light?
Absolutely. Anytime that in normal circumstances, the elephant in the room in the Democratic Party is the unions. And the elephant in the room in the Republican Party, at least formally, used to be the Chamber of Commerce. And so those they have a particular sway in their respective caucuses.
Yeah, I think Lamar is dead on that one. And it's I do hear and I again, I appreciate the SAG approach that maybe that could work. But I still think it's such a unique institution. I mean, can you imagine the governor's office unionizing and senior staff and all of a sudden said, no, governor, we're not going to travel this weekend. Our contract says we get weekends off. As I said, I can see it in bureaucratic offices, things like that, where you're dealing less with immediate policy. You're doing more day-to-day operations. You've got to be able to, unfortunately, hire and fire and not go through the union rigmarole. And everyone ultimately works for the majority leader, and everyone works ultimately for the Speaker of the House. And here's another point, and Lamar, again, it's good to see you and to chat with you. Let's say the Republicans take back the House. So then do they decertify the union? Then Democrats come back and they win. So they recertify the unions, and then the Republicans win and they decertify. I mean, another point, and I think Lamar would agree with this. I've seen some of our former colleagues, club members, as we jokingly call ourselves sometimes, there have been some jerks out there, not necessarily Democrat or Republican, just some bad legislators. The point is, I've seen staff on both sides of the aisle help that person get out of a bad situation and find another job, whether it's in another office, central staff, maybe in a department, and then try to find somebody that can deal with that person. At the end of the day, we're not just pushing paper. We're having to deal with people on a much more intimate level than just a Good morning, Representative Lemons. I'm here today at 9 o'clock. I'm punching out at 5 o'clock. What you do is your business. I'm just going to answer the phone. It doesn't work that way.
Representative Lemons, though, I want to get your response. This is my last question to Representative Kerry Reimgens, who said, we should put our money where our mouths are. If we're a Democratic trifecta, we should be working to protect the workers who work for us. What's wrong with that philosophy?
There's nothing wrong with that philosophy, but how can you do it in a realistic fashion? As Senator Smith just pointed out, it's too much fluidity in terms of leadership, in terms of a party leadership, in terms of a partisan leadership. Again, I don't want to beat a dead horse. When you mentioned it, the only way I thought it could possibly work is that individuals belong, and then you can select from those or bring people to the SAG union. So if you decided to bring in a campaign worker and put them on your staff, and usually that person does have a loyalty to that person because they helped you get there, then that person can join the SAG union and be protected. And you would have to, just like SAG workers are, because of the arts, they work and they don't work, right? And that would be the same thing here. But as far as like anything else, that's the only model I see possibly working.
Lamar, just to kind of confirm, Representative Lemons, I mean, is this an idea that you would say you were against?
I would be against having any particular union that's actively involved in the political process themselves or engaging their members to do such. So, and for instance, in the race I just came off of, I happened to be in the union that they were, or my wife is in the union that had supported my opponent. And so they were mailing to her to support my opponent. So I got all their mailing. So I know what, and it was affiliate, and it was a larger affiliate. So like the AFL would include a teachers union and a series of other unions. So they were all together working. So you can't have those type of things. And that's within a party. Remember, I am a Democrat. Those are Democratic union, usually supportive of Democratic candidates. And they decided to get involved in a primary. And extensively so.
You know, I think my final question would be, and I'll make this kind of the speed round. I would love to hear both what you have to say, Senator Schmidt, and what you have to say, Representative Lemons. But I mean, how does this ultimately affect constituents and voters? How should they be feeling about this circulating headline?
Again, the Democratic base are going to say, yeah, everybody should be in the union. But they don't know the intricacies of how it works. So in the general sense, we all will say as a Democrat, yes, we support unions. But in the practical sense, it has to be a type of union in this type of model that is nonpartisan.
Since the Democrats are in charge now, I'm deferring that. That was a good answer by my former colleague. I would tend to say, again, the intricacies and the uniqueness of the legislature, the need for a union is really not there. The majority leader, the Speaker of the House, can step in. We've seen that happen when representatives and or senators have treated staff poorly. They step in. The House and Senate business offices have HR personnel and can step in. And I think that's the best way to handle the situation right now. I would be against unionization, not because I'm against unions, but in this particular setting, you have two people in an office. No, that's whether you have a union card or not, it doesn't work.
Scale of 1 through 10, how likely do you think they'll be able to pull it off?
1-4.
I like his optimism. He was always good on the around the Capitol to see him. So I like your optimism.
Everybody, that is former State Senator Wayne Schmidt and former State Representative Lamar Lemons. Thank you both for taking the time to join us on the MERS Monday podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Great to be on.
Joining us for our second segment of the MERS Monday podcast is Lindsay Huddleston II, the present-day head of Sport Psychology Solutions, which is a Lansing-based consultation provider on athlete media training, sports policy, and navigation around name, image, and likeness deals. Hey, Lindsay, how are you doing today?
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Thank you for having me.
No, thank you so much for coming on. So just to kind of give our listeners some insight on what we will be talking about right now, on March 6th, I covered a Senate Oversight Committee meeting that heard testimony on House Bill 4816, permitting high school athletes to enter contracts and agreements to earn compensation off their name, image, and likeness, or NIL, through obtaining approval from the Michigan High School Athletics Association and with parental consent if they're under 18 years old. This comes during a time of the young social media influencer. And after I personally looked at the On3 NIL 100, a weekly list of college and high school athletes who have the highest NIL profitability potential, majorly based on their social media reach, I found that in terms of top NIL valuations for high school athletes, there's a 16-year-old basketball player in Cleveland, Ohio, whose following is worth $1.2 million in NIL deals. And when I covered this story earlier this month, I came across a Michigan high schooler, a Belleville football quarterback, whose influence could be worth $934,000 in NIL deals. Kyle, I have to ask, because you do coach cross country and track, what are your thoughts on this?
I want to see how my daughter can get into some of that action, but I don't know if she's that good, and I don't know if her following's that good, but she does have Greg the Frog, or is it Crank Greg? G-R-E-G-G.
A frog of sorts.
Yeah, it's like a frog. It's on Instagram or something like that. So if anybody wants to get the ball rolling so she can get that kind of following, I'm all for it.
But Lindsay, the reason why we had you on, I mean, can you tell us what exactly is happening right now when it comes to high school athletes and earning money off their NIL?
No, great question and great description indeed of all the things that are happening. And Kyle, I want to wish your daughter the best in signing that NIL deal. Hopefully it'll work out for you guys.
Thank you.
It is, for lack of a better term, or a term that's been associated with college NIL, it has the potential to be the wild, wild west if organizations like the Michigan High School Athletic Association and individuals like Representative Jimmy Wilson Jr. don't come forward to try to put things in place so athletes of all levels, whether it's the individual you're talking about in Belleville, who happens to be Bryce Underwood, outstanding young man, or someone who is reflecting what Kyle is talking about, who may not be a major athlete, but has the ability to have social media influence. I think education is key for the general population, and people need to know that all NIL valuations are not the same, and there's opportunity for many people to get involved.
Okay, so how does it work right now? So if I'm a high school athlete, I was a swimmer back in the day, and I got some sort of deal, would that make me viewed as ineligible to compete now in the current state of Michigan? Or would the Michigan High School Sports Association would ultimately view it as me just doing my own thing on social media?
Yeah, great question. What it really comes down to is your amateur status. Currently, if individuals sign contracts for their name, image, and likeness in high school, because there is not a law that allows that, they will be impacting their amateur status, meaning all the games that they played and won, they have the there's an opportunity for those games to go back and be denied because these individuals are ineligible. So that is the whole concern. So when you mentioned Bryce Underwood by his specifications and what he's doing, if he was to go ahead right now and follow through on some of those deals, sign those deals, get paid for that as an amateur athlete without this law being in place, people can protest the games that he wins. His entire season could be all for naught. And if they have the luxury of going back to another state championship game, which they've done in past seasons, that could be null and void as well. So it's really to protect the individual status. And even though all these are amateurs, they can end up making money and then not go against their amateur status.
Would it be games that had already been played going backwards, or would it be games going forward?
Well, it could be, depending on what happens, worst case scenario, someone went forward and didn't respect the fact that this law is not in place. It could be the game, any games they played going forward, but also you can lose your eligibility to play any more games. If an individual jumped on that and signed those deals right now without this law being in place, they can affect their eligibility status, not even to play going forward. So you miss out on all the potential. And true indeed, games that have been played, whether they're won or lost, if someone goes and say, well, we're going to strip you from that game, That's more of a historical standpoint. But going forward, when you say, well, this person can't participate in any of these sporting events, if they do, the entire game will be ruled null and void. That can be problematic. So you want to make sure individuals are on the right side of the law. So as this bill begins to progress, it already passed the House. And as Sam, as you know, is making its way through Senate committee oversight. The next steps will be for it to get some more testimony, get further along. If there are any adjustments that will be made, there may be some possible adjustments. Then it can make it through the Senate with support, hopefully get immediate effect and be signed by the governor. So as soon as later this year, I'm thinking individuals can sign those deals and go forward and benefit off their name, image, and likeness without any negative consequences.
Lindsay, all right, as the Gen Xer here in the room, can you explain to me how do these young athletes make money based on their social media following? I don't understand this. Maybe Sam can help too. How does this happen? As a Gen Xer, I'm just not attached in that whole like realm. So I don't understand how people can make money off that.
Yeah, and it's tough, Kyle. I understand, because you can look at it from a standpoint that social media is looked at something that's recreational, slightly entertaining. But for many of these young people, they're completely engulfed, and this is a primary part of their lifestyle. I mean, from how many times they check their phone to how they communicate. So there's a strong presence many of them have. And advertising dollars can benefit from this social media support that a lot of these individuals have, because if I'm a young athlete that has an influence and people are looking at me, I can mention a brand. And because of my connection to that brand can benefit. And we're going to see that on all levels, whether it's hospitals, car dealerships, restaurants, clothing stores, or just small mom and pop operations that are clever enough to make the connection with that popular athlete to promote their brand.
You know, in your work with NIL consultation, have you come across any businesses that wanted a deal and you're like, oh, that's kind of interesting?
Yeah, like I was saying earlier, you're right. It's funny. It's like when I think about that question, there's almost a question mark with that, because it's really the next business that feels they can do it. I've had business owners come to me and say, Lindsay, I don't see how I can get a return on investment by investing in a high school athlete. However, if you look at your business model, for example, if you're a local car dealership in a relatively small community, if you connect with one of the most popular high school athletes, these athletes are of age where they're going to be getting their driver's license. And despite how technology is, we still are relying on people driving cars themselves. So it's not just completely automated. You can have a very strong network of individuals who want to come in and get their first car or pre-owned car from a local dealership. So it's really all about how clever, how committed businesses want to be when they engage these individuals. So whether it's a car dealership, like I said before, I haven't seen anything. No, I do take it back. And this was more of a collegiate NIL deal, but a local business in the East Lansing area, a local hot dog stand, I can't remember their name, but they were like selling hot dogs. They connected with some of the MSU athletes to do an NIL deal. And I don't know what the particulars of that, whether it's just free hot dogs for the rest of the season, also something monetary, but it can just be any individual outside of those prohibited, which are companies that are trying to promote alcohol sales, firearm sales, anything that would be explicit for a minor to participate in. So I would pretty much say common sense ideas, but I would say they could be a very huge range of individuals, businesses that can get representation through NIL.
You know, mentioning that Twisters, which is over on Waverly here in Lansing, had a new It was like a flurry that had Darius Snow's name on it. So it was like the Darius Snow flurry. It was his own concoction, and you could buy it. It had a picture of him on it and everything. So that was one example. And then Tyson Walker from the basketball team just recently had something at Moneyball down here on Saginaw, where he was selling something of his likeness on a T-shirt.
Yeah, he has some
merch. Those are a couple options.
You're all over it, Kyle. You're hip to everything that's going on this NIL, man. You guys got it. But you're right. These college athletes have leveraged that. But you just named two examples. You mentioned Moneyball. Shout out to Desmond Ferguson, a senior founder of Moneyball. These businesses have to be proactive, too. I think part of what the education SBS is going to give as I travel throughout the state, because in the actual legislation, by June 30th, 2026, MHSA has to be able to present a written document stating that Michigan high schools are effectively ready to take on NIL, giving them some time. So part of what my crusade, I would say, is going to be is to share this information with as many people as possible, so business can know that they can engage in a way where it doesn't always have to be a huge contract, but some kind of way they can make that connection. And I think what happens is that so many people think they may be priced out of the opportunity, or because the athlete isn't a top rated, nationally ranked Division I athlete that's playing either football or basketball, they can't get an NIL deal. It can be for anything, for anyone who's willing to be engaging and show some professionalism as it relates to promoting a brand.
How many high schoolers are you currently working with in your current role?
And I would say close to a dozen or so individuals I deal with, but I don't want to focus solely on me being the only individual who can help. I think with anything, it's all about having the right fit. So when you choose your doctor or choose your lawyer, you want to be able to have the right fit. And one of the educational goals I have in using SPS as a PSA for high school name, image, and likeness is to let people know they need to find people they can connect with, that they can work with to build these relationships. And this is only preparing them for what's going to be next after they navigate through college and go on to the professional world as it relates to building business relationships and having success going forward.
So is that about a dozen? Is that a mix of high school and college, or is it just high school athletes?
No, these are just people that are within my personal network. I mean, technically, although SBS has launched this campaign, I think more people are waiting. And a matter of fact, after the Senate hearing committee that you and I experienced, I got a plethora of calls and people wanting to connect from different parts of the state, different sports. I know, for example, I got a note from a good friend of mine who's a coach who has a very successful female golf team in mid-Michigan. So that's a different dynamic. Calls from other individuals. So I think as this legislation continues to progress and people realize that there are different touch points based on what type of representation that you bring, that people can find different ways of getting involved. But as they get more information, I think they're going to respond. And again, I don't want to just be the only individual that is navigating this process. I want people to be able to make connections with individuals that may work for them. But if they feel that working with SBS can give them the best opportunity for success, I'm all for that too.
I want to dive into a more serious conversation, though, about social media safety. What are you advising these young people to do to make sure that while they have these social media accounts, they're operating them in a safe fashion?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. And it's easy to take for granted the impact social media can have, not only with one's physical health, but from a mental health standpoint. Being sure not to allow the desire to have an NIL contract affect you in a way where your anxiety and things like depression are becoming overwhelming. So from a safety standpoint, just really knowing that you have to really be mindful of the social media communication that you have. In most cases, we're communicating with people on social media that we know both in the real world as well as in the digital world. But when you start getting more attention for business opportunities, you may be very careful as you direct message individuals, probably want to have another level of follow-up that can include other individuals, make people aware of who you're talking to and who you're meeting with, that if things go from the standpoint where someone says, hey, I got this idea and I would love to bring you on board. Well, you want to make sure that there's another adult that's involved in that, as opposed to you taking meetings and connecting with people. Because unfortunately, as we all know, people can really use social media in a very negative way. So from a safety standpoint, I would say always have a buffer, always try to follow the best social media etiquette as possible. And also know that this is about preparing individuals to be young professionals and professionals to be able to handle things the right way.
When I was, I think I was a sophomore in high school when I got my first ever Instagram account. I was 16. And the idea of having a public Instagram account terrified me, because you hear about bad actors, you hear about predatorial individuals looking at your account. I can't help but be very transparent and just say that sometimes I even think it seems like an uncomfortable concept that a 16-year-old could have 70,000 followers plus of people they've never met before. How do you navigate that fear of bad actors on the online world?
Yeah, you know, it's funny when you talk about a young person having 70,000 people. You know, you and I as professionals, you say we don't even know 70,000 people. A lot of these, I won't go as far as I say are electronic robots, but people that may have fake accounts, not to say that they're intent is to be a bad actor, but they're not as directly engaged. There's always going to be a smaller group like that. But I think with anything, as things grow and evolve, we have to be careful of where the possible landmines are. But, you know, we're still dealing with the same basic principles of stranger danger. If you don't know this individual, don't make yourself completely available to them. Even for me, when I get prospects reaching out to me on social media as an adult and as a professional, I'm still mindful. Some things I filter through. Some things don't even get a response if it's not them presenting themselves in a way where it seems like it can be something I can look into. A perfect example I will give is when someone's communicating with you about a professional opportunity, well, first of all, the way they communicate should be professional, appropriate, grammatically correct as much as possible, just letting you know that there's a standard. And I think once that standard is met, you don't allow yourself to go beyond that threshold where someone can just send you a message with the emoji or how should I say, no profile picture, where you don't even know who you're dealing with, or it's not an individual you can readily recognize. So I think just like with all things, you want to be careful walking across the street, looking both ways. You want to be doing the same thing when you're on social media.
I remember at that committee hearing, there were some concerns about should this legislation be amended to ensure that attendance, classroom attendance is required, mandated as you have one of these contracts. So what are your thoughts on that idea?
Yeah, that's a great question. That was Senator Dana Pohanky who made that suggestion. But I will emphasize, she just wanted to make sure the word attendance was acknowledged. Currently, as the bill is written, it's still expected that individuals will not miss school for any type of contractual obligation. Her concern was that it was mentioned, that it was referenced, that there's an emphasis placed on that. So for the interest of legislation being able to navigate, or as we will say sometime, be as clean as possible, I think that's going to be able to be taken care of and addressed without any major changes to the bill, because it already does state that an individual cannot miss any type of school for any contractual obligation they have in relation to NIL. But I think she just wanted the terminology to find its way in there in some way. But that's a great question. That was a great response by her too.
How about our reporting requirements for how much time you spend creating content?
Yeah, I know Senator McMorrow mentioned that. And I think that's something that we may have to delve in a little bit more, because whether we as professionals, when we submit our timesheets, that's a way to do hourly reporting. But I have to think that as individual sole entrepreneurs, I don't know if individuals emphasize that as much. And although I would expect anything happening with NIL with these athletes is preparing them for what to do going forward in their professional careers, I would be willing to have more dialogue with Senator McMorrow about that and bring a few more stakeholders in to make sure her concerns are met, because I also remember her stating that she would just want it to be in line with what is already expected in current law. So I just think that needs to be a little bit more conversation. But fortunately, we have some time for some more testimony and some dialogue with individuals about some of those subjects that you brought up.
One quick question. What about the concern about bad acting parents?
That was a great point that she brought up. And I acknowledge that in my testimony to the committee. She talked about a Wall Street Journal article and all these. And yeah, people are sick, you know, and it's unfortunate. But I think MHSA being the organization that has to approve these contracts gives a little buffer, meaning that the one thing is that word travels in this sports community. And you probably remember when you were a swimmer in high school, and Kyle, even I know you're an avid runner within your community, word travels as far as who's doing what. So MHSA always has an open line. And that's something I really hold in high regard for them, that you can communicate with them. And the word gets out that if said parent is really a bad actor and people know, and these things, the word would get out. And having an organization like MHSA to be able to push back, or to be able to take the information they have, because my understanding is that they will sign off on these opportunities within receiving it within 7 days. But if they have been loaded with people sharing information about potential bad actors, I don't think these things will get to that point where they'll be able to be signed off on. Or if they are signed off on, believe me, that hotline will get to blowing up and people will be calling and telling what's going on, and they'll be able to be investigated and addressed, I think.
And just a final question. I mean, you were someone who was a legislative liaison for the Granholm administration. You were a lobbyist for Walmart. How did you end up here? How did your path bring you to this latest role?
Well, I guess the best way to answer that question is the all-time classic line in The Godfather. Every time I try to get out, they pull me back in. But I will say it's been a great evolution. I stepped away from state government and the private sector sometime to actually reconnect with young people. That's when I was getting my master's in sports psychology and trying to help. But as I continue to be on the front lines dealing with our youth, I continue to see these issues evolve from a policy standpoint. I want to give a special shout out to Matt Gillard, president and CEO of Michigan's Children, being a policy associate with Michigan's Children, and Matt just being a sports guy, former legislator. He gets it and also recognizes this is actually a child welfare issue when we're putting young people in a position to be able to be proactive and kind of get out in front of things for their financial future as well as their career. It allowed me to be able to come full circle and bring all my skill sets to bear. I'm very passionate about our young people, do a lot of work with sports psychology, even working with the collegiate athletes or spending time doing media with a coach like Tom Izzo. You kind of know what the expectations are. So I'm able to take all that and come back to our high school students and be able to help be a great porter of them to be able to navigate this process. And I love sports and I can't get away from the policy work. And when I'm working on policy issues that I care about, sometimes it's a walk in the park and I'm okay with that. So that's what brings me full circle. And I'm happy to be able to come full circle on an issue like this.
Everybody, that is Lindsay Huddleston, the second, the present day head of Sports Psychology Solutions. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I am personally very excited to hear what comes out of this segment of the MERS Monday podcast, which will be an interview with Executive Director Amy McMillan of the Huron-Clinton Metro Park System, which consists of 13 parks serving Livingston, Macomb, Oakland, and Washtenaw and Wayne counties. They were approved by the various county residents in 1940 and currently are made up of 25,000 acres of parks and natural areas and nearly 400 miles of trails. When it comes to the Metro Park System's economic benefits report, the parks generate $92.4 million annually in direct visitor spending. And I have to make an honest disclaimer to our listeners today. I personally live near the Lake St. Clair Metro Park, and I have to say it is my fluffy husky Jasper's favorite place for our walks, especially because it's right next to the local Frosty Boy ice cream shop where I take him for pup cups afterward. So Amy, just to give our listeners some more information on who you are and your journey to enter into this role, I'd like to know, how exactly does one become an executive director of a Metro Park system like this?
It is kind of a long and winding road. I started my career at the Metro Park as an intern in 1988, I'm afraid to tell you. And at that time, Lake St. Clair was known as Metro Beach, Metro Park. And I learned a ton about the Metro Park at that time. And I went on to graduate from college, and I got a job being the director in Superior Charter Township. And I went on from there as a director to the city of Ypsilanti, and from there to Genesee County for a little over 19 years. And then the position opened in the Metro Parks, and I had always had this goal of returning to the Metro Parks as the director, because, you know, the Metro Parks is this insanely great system. And in 2018, I was lucky enough to be selected by the Board of Commissioners to be the director, and I have been here ever since.
What county do you live in?
Right now, I live in Genesee County.
And you have a home, I think you were telling us before this podcast segment began, a home of 5 dogs, including some poodles, 3 cats, and 2 horses, correct?
Very close. 4 dogs, which makes me sound a little more sane than 5. But yes, I have a couple of rescue standards from Michigan Standard Poodle Rescue. If you are ever looking for a fantastic dog, they are a great organization to rescue from. And then I have an older lab and a young miniature poodle. So we have all kinds of personalities and a bunch of feet running around my house. And then I live here because this is where my horses live. I have a 28-year-old horse who was born here and has lived here his entire life. So this is where we live.
I'm a little bit curious. How do you summarize how exactly these parks get funded? I know that there are visitor payments. I know that people spend money on recreational activities in the parks. And then there's also municipal county contributions. So what exactly is the funding formula here?
Sure. So there is a pretty broad menu of how the Metro Parks are funded. So when the Metro Parks were first created by an act of the legislature in 1939, the legislature said, hey, we're going to create this authority to create this regional park system. And the people of the five counties are going to have to vote to fund it. So in 1940, the people of southeastern Michigan and all five counties said, we will fund this metropolitan park system, this authority, in perpetuity. We will pay 0.25 mils, a quarter of a mil, to ensure that there is funding to first, most of the funding went to acquiring property, right? Because when the system was formed, there were 0 acres of property, and now we have 25,000 acres of property, and then to operate and maintain it. So over the course of this entire period of time, we have our largest source of funding is the millage, and the millage generates about 60-ish percent of our budget in any given year. Our second highest source of funding does come from park entrance fees. So those entrance fees are, they come in the form of either annual permits. You can buy a permit for your car and come to as many parks in the Metro Park system as many times as you want all year long. Or you can buy a daily permit, and that will allow you to come to as many parks on that day as you want to come to. Our third highest source of revenue is golf. As you probably know, we have 7 great courses throughout the entire park system. They are consistently ranked as among the top public golf courses in southeastern Michigan. And one of the things that has been really exciting to us over the course of the last almost 4 years now is that since the pandemic, people have rediscovered golf. There was probably a decade when golf revenue everywhere across the United States was either flat or declining. But when the pandemic hit, there was this surge of interest in golf again. So people who might have had clubs that were gathering dust in their garage or their basement dusted them off and started coming out. And also we have a ton of new golfers on our course.
I have a quick question. So if these local community residents, if they're contributing to the parks through millages already, why do they still need to buy the visitor pass?
Well, because the visitor pass is part of our overall revenue picture, right? There, it without the additional funding from admission fees, we would not be able to sustain our budget. And so we work really hard to keep that fee affordable to people. There is the annual permit. So, you know, there's the economy of scale of that. And then during the summer, we have a trade-in program where if you have, you buy dailies when you come to the park, right? So you spend $10 a daily permit. And if you keep that permit, you can collect up to 4 of those and turn them in for a dollar per dollar value toward an annual permit. Or if you're like, hey, I've collected 2 of them and I've got $20, you get the dollar for dollar with that as well. And that's been really a very popular program in the last few years.
One of the specific reasons you're here with us today, because when this episode comes out on Monday afternoon, the Huron-Clinton Metro Park System will have launched the Metro Parks and Me initiative aimed at raising $2.4 million over 3 years to add more in-school science learning programs and free swim lessons. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about this initiative that's being launched?
100%. We are so excited to share the Metro Parks and Me program. And this is something we've been working on for a while. The Metro Parks have been doing outdoor education since 1950. We are great at it. We win all kinds of awards locally, regionally, across the United States. And one of the things that we know is that there is this tremendous need throughout the five county area and certainly beyond for more programs to connect kids to the outdoors and particularly to connect kids to the science of outdoors. We hear that from teachers. We hear that from families. So we have a program that is called Supplemental Science. And we've been piloting this program for a couple of years in the city of Detroit. And our goal with Metro Parks and Me is to grow this program, to be able to provide it in more schools throughout the entire region. So we can connect kids to the outdoors. We can help improve those scores on tests. We can, more importantly, instill in kids this connection and this wonder and this sense of responsibility and stewardship for nature, and hopefully through all of these programs that we do, also inspire kids to be involved in science in some way, shape, or form as part of a career and a lifelong commitment.
In terms of quantity, how many more in-school science learning programs do you hope to be added on because of this initiative?
Well, in the last year in school, we had 2,000 field trips, 800 educational programs, and overall, we impacted 206,000 students. We see that program through these contributions, whether they're from corporations or philanthropy or individuals, easily doubling and beyond over the course of the next several years with this program.
I know that right now in Lansing, it is budget making season, getting ready to appropriate things for the next fiscal year 2025. Do you have any appropriations requests for state legislators?
We do not have any appropriations requests for legislators specifically this year. The legislature was super generous to us. Last year, we received a $5 million appropriation to restore the North Marina at Lake St. Clair. We're really good at getting grants that are available through the state, through the DNR, through the Land and Water Trust Fund Program, through the Michigan Natural Resources Trust Fund Program. Last year, and this was one of those programs that came out of nowhere, and it was a one-time program. There was a high water grant, and we also received, I think it was $1.5 million for work to our parking lot at Lake St. Clair, which, you know, is a heat island, and will help install some green infrastructure there and also help with our stormwater management. And so our focus right now with the state of Michigan is to aggressively pursue the grant opportunities that are available in terms of improving our facilities, supporting the larger work that we're doing in terms of connectivity, in terms of stormwater management. Our focus is on those funding programs. We know less dollars are available coming out of the state this year. Last year, we were super successful, and it was the first ask we've made.
I do have a quick question, though. When it comes to this $2.4 million you're hoping to raise over these 3 years, where do you hope that money comes from? You're talking about grants. Do you want it to be specifically grants? Are you looking for donations?
Our focus is on working with the private philanthropic sector, with foundations, and with corporations to achieve that funding goal.
I mean, what are some of the biggest difficulties right now facing your parks?
I will say to you, frankly, I come from really under-resourced communities. So the type of challenges I faced in those communities are really different than we have at the Metro Parks. In many ways, we have an extraordinary privilege in having a perpetual millage. So, you know, we're not trying to run a millage campaign every few years. We have good, sound business practices around our revenue generating facilities. So if we don't have a really bad weather year, for example, that rains us out of golf, we have a really solid revenue stream there. The challenges that we have are, I think the challenges that almost every, well, certainly every park system and every community faces. You know, in many ways, the metro parks are like small cities. We have Kensington Metro Park itself is over 5,000 acres, and we have our own maintenance with DPW, we have our own police department, we have all of those responsibilities, and so challenges are always keeping up with the age of our infrastructure. We've been lucky that over the years we've had a good track record of maintaining our infrastructure, so we're not in the kind of dire straits that some communities are, but that is always a challenge, always keeping up with the paving. This year, we are doing all of the design and securing funding to reopen the Great Wave Pool at Lake Erie. That was a huge project. We weren't expecting that the infrastructure of that pool to fail as catastrophically as it did when it did. We are looking toward some big needs, and we are pursuing some federal funding, for example, at Lake St. Clair Metro Park, where our power grid is very old and we own it. So it is our responsibility. So there are always the infrastructure needs that we are working toward, whether they are funding them through our own budget, putting some money aside year after year, securing grants, working with the philanthropic community, looking at opportunities for the state and the federal government to address, working with partners.
We were recently talking about how it's a little bit warmer this winter, okay? So has this year presented any obstacles in terms of warmer weather and more people wanting to utilize these parks as early as February?
So it depends on whether you're a fan of winter or not, whether it was a problem. I am not a big fan of winter, so early spring is exciting to me. Folks who are big cross-country skiers were really disappointed in the weather this winter. But for us, we are up and we are ready and we are open. And yeah, we're seeing early crowds. We are seeing, we opened our golf courses a week ago. It's earliest we've opened our golf courses in over 20 years. We have a really great, really highly skilled workforce, and they are ready and they are on it. So, you know, we've been welcoming bigger crowds ever since the weather has improved. We were able to open Sheldon Trails, our mountain biking trail system at Stoney. If you haven't been and you're a mountain biker, seriously, you're going to want to go. Tons of people are out fishing. The ice fishermen, very disappointed in the weather, but the boat launches are crazy busy. So yeah, if you want to be outdoors, come on out to the Metro Parks. We have got all kinds of amazing opportunities just waiting for you.
I know that you do have more seasonal staff members than full-time workers. You have 350 seasonal staff members and 200 full-time workers. Is that a challenge that because crowds are coming in early, do you have to maybe try to find a way that you can tap in some of those seasonal workers to come on board early?
Those are the correct numbers for full-time and seasonals, but we also have part-time employees that work for us year-round. And we have a little over 500 part-time folks who work for us in varying hours throughout the year. And so we're not ready for summer numbers in March, but we have sufficient staff to be open, to be operating at the high standards that you are looking for. And I'm going to tell you, if you are looking for a summer job, come to the Metro Parks. I got my start as a summer employee in my hometown. So who knows where that's going to take you. And one of the things that we've done to attract and retain our seasonal workforce is we offer an hourly bonus during the summertime. So if you work a certain number of hours, you get a certain number of dollars. And when you work more, you get more. And if you stay all the way through the end of the season, you get another bonus on top of that. And plus, seriously, great place to work.
What is your workforce like? Have you experienced any shortages? What's kind of going on with the efficiency of who you have right now?
2 years ago, I will tell you, it was really rough hiring and retaining folks. And, you know, you were seeing stories about that on the national news, just how hard it was to attract employees to from anything from full-time positions to seasonal positions. That has changed a lot over the course of, I would say, the last 6 months or so. We had, I don't know, half a dozen full-time positions that were open at the beginning of the year, and we have filled all except one of those, and we have interviews for the full-time position that's open next week. We're seeing a high percentage of returning employees in our seasonal workforce, and our part-time workforce is pretty steady throughout the year. So we think things are looking up on that track. The biggest challenge I will say to you that we have in every parks organization that has aquatic facilities is always attracting lifeguards and being able to train lifeguards and hire lifeguards. But even that's gotten a little bit better in the course of last year. You know, we didn't get a chance much to talk about our swim program. But part of that Everyone in the Pool program is training kids who are learning to swim today. Ultimately, hope that many of them will be part of our lifeguard force in the future. And we've started doing some lifeguard training programs that are free for people who want to learn to be a lifeguard. And we're working with some of our partners through our Everyone in the Pool program to develop some training hubs for lifeguards throughout the region so that we can have, you know, a better trained, better staff lifeguard force. We were talking about Lake St. Clair earlier. Lots of people who live in or who, you know, grown up around Lake St. Clair, that's the place we have the least trouble attracting lifeguards because, right, they're growing up in the water and in swim programs.
I have to disclose, I myself personally am a former lifeguard from St. Clair Shores to fit the stereotype.
If you'd like to be recertified and you're looking for a couple of extra bucks this summer, give us a call.
But would you say, is this like a lifeguard shortage? Would you just go as far as say that?
There's a national lifeguard shortage. Last summer, there were all kinds of stories in some of the, you know, the major newspapers. The New York Times was running stories about lifeguard shortages, the Wall Street Journal. It's been a trend that has been years in the making.
That is Executive Director Amy McMillan of the Huron-Clinton Metro Park System, again, consisting of 13 parks in Livingston, Macomb, Oakland, Washtenaw, and Wayne counties. Thank you for joining us on the MERS Monday podcast.
You are welcome. Thanks so much for having me, and hope to see you out at Lake St. Clair sometime soon with that dog of yours.
You probably will. Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
And that is going to do it for today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. Just to clarify for our listeners, today's second and third segments were pre-recorded in advance on Friday, March 8th. Also, all interviews are subjected to editing for the purpose of time and listenability. But as we conclude things today, I would like to express my tremendous appreciation to all of our guests, former State Senator Wayne Schmidt, a Traverse City Republican, and past Detroit Democratic State Rep Lamar Lemons III for participating in our roundtable discussion. Thank you to founder Lindsay Huddleston II of Sports Psychology Solutions, and to director Amy McMillan of the Huron-Clinton Metro Park System. And as always, I would like to express my great gratitude to MERS editor Kyle Mullen for helping me prepare today's episode, and special thanks to Jeff Smith, who's affiliated with Mark Bayshore Audio in Okemos, which puts this audio together. Until next time, I am your host, Samantha Shriver.